There is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pits of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination in an area which we call Elder Dragon Journey.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're live back at the Elder Dragon Drama Podcast. This is your host Igor, and as always with me is my co-host Niksha. Say hi, Niksha.
Hi, you wonderful people.
All six of you. Also, my girlfriend says hi. But we have brought somebody else because we're having a Battle Bond preview show. And we have brought a special person who actually visited us last week. So, special person, who is you?
Good morning, everybody. Or should I say good afternoon? Because, there's a bit of a time difference between us. I'm Jesse, otherwise known as Pongo, sometimes on the competitive EDH Discord, and I'm one of the dudes from Team Turn 3.
Yeah, and somehow he ended up in Croatia last week and decided to play a couple of games with us.
Yeah, it was totally worth it. I had a great time. Thanks for having me again.
You were basically mopping the floor with us. Of course, you had a good time.
So well, you know.
But yeah, we had some couple of good games, and then he asked, could he come by to the Battle Bond the preview show? And we were like, sure. So he'll even give us a couple of competitive EDH views, but we'll mostly stick to just the regular-ish EDH, because we have a kind of a discrepancy in the show.
Right. Yeah, so I'm going to try to present everything from a more, well, at least my opinions about certain cards from a more competitive perspective. And, as somebody who's played EDH at every sort of part of the power level spectrum, I'll try to provide a fair opinion from more casual perspectives as well.
That is fair enough, but before we begin with the Battle Bond, we need to do the Commander of the Week segment, right?
Yep.
So, Nexha, what was your Commander of the Week?
I'm going to go with KNT again, because there's just something nice about playing big dumb things and turning them sideways. Playing Modern, I'm used to just, like, winning without attacking, because people see Eldrazi Titan, they'd concede, or, you know, turn 3 Karn. But, yeah, just, you know, doing it the old-fashioned way it feels nice.
Yeah, only thing I minded about your KNT deck was when you almost had infinite turns but decided not to pull the trigger when we were playing some games.
I mean, I don't do those kind of things unless people, you know, irk me.
I mean, when you're playing with us, you should just, you know, go for the kill, shuffle up next game, and that's it.
I'll remember that.
He was looking over my shoulder, and I think he saw that I had some interaction in my hand.
Cheater. But usually, even if somebody wins, let's say, extra turns, I'm like, okay, we get to play more Magic, and that's it. Combos are just part of the game, in my mind.
But it's a completely, like, I never thought about it when I was constructing the deck, but it just turns out that Conqueror's Foothold is a really good land.
Yep.
What was the combo? Well, the combo is basically you get a lot of mana, you have Conqueror's Foothold, and then you play any extra turn spell that doesn't exile itself, so you get infinite turns.
And just rinse and repeat.
Yeah, just, you know, get it back, play it again, get it back.
If I remember correctly, Jesse actually had Ancient Grudge in his hand for that.
Right.
But still.
Because
Niksha didn't win that game, it took us like a good 45 minutes to end that game, if I remember correctly.
I don't remember it being that long.
I think it was because that was the game where I was trying to win with Helm of the Host like 3 times.
Yeah, you did try.
I always have to try.
It took long enough that game that Niksha had at least 12 mana, right? If he was going to be activating Conqueror's Foothold and playing an extra turn spell every turn.
Oh, I had 12 lands, to be correct. But yeah. I did have Mirari's Wake, so a bit more mana than that.
Yeah, it was an absurd amount of mana. You can make a lot of stuff happen in competitive with that kind of mana.
See, that's because I was playing Tess's Saskia, not anything of mine that actually destroys lands.
See, this is why we have to destroy lands, boys and girls.
There you go.
And that's the degeneracy of turn 300 infinite turn combos.
Make sure you were going to say.
Well, that's why I have KNT. They can just rebuild those lands. I even upped my land count to 42 to get them more often.
So what I'm hearing is, Igor, please play more land destruction with me. Okay, we can do that.
Sure, I'd like to see you try.
I mean, I always try to kill the lands, you know.
I know.
But, Jesse, do you have any commander of the week?
Well, I mean, I think it would probably be a competitive EDH meme if I just said the true answer, which is, as always, Thrasios and Timna. However, my commander of the week, my actual commander of the week, I guess I would have to give it to Timna and Krom.
Because, hey.
I do think that's a very interesting pair, and in competitive EDH, they're sort of more my speed in the sense that it's kind of like a controlling, sort of mid-rangey deck that tries to win just through sheer card advantage before actually pulling a trigger. And that's a style of gameplay that I just quite enjoy a lot. So yeah, and a little bit out of the norm as well for competitive.
Yeah, because Chrome is like 5 mana, and that's almost infinity in CDH.
Right, and this is a deck, however, that's like happy to play the game at sort of any speed, just because you're running two commanders that generate like a lot of card advantage. Krom has haste, which is surprising, but it oftentimes he just kind of gets in there and starts pressuring people. And then the deck can also win by casting Angel's Grace and Ad Nauseam to just sort of draw the entire deck. And so it can win quickly, or it can keep up in terms of card draw with a lot of the other decks in the format.
But most importantly, it plays Timna, and that's it.
Exactly.
that's a fair magic card.
I remember Krom as being like the best partner with Vial Smasher.
Oh yeah.
Because it was like, just if Vial Smasher survives and you play Krom, that's like 9 damage in that.
Are we talking 1v1?
Yeah, while Vial Smasher was still legal.
Yeah. Cuz that just sounds busted.
For that 1 month, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh man, when every deck was a Vial Smasher deck.
Oh, Nexha was really on Vial Smasher train. He was really playing it.
Yeah, but I built it with a plan to not use it because I knew like Vial Smasher just cannot be legal in a format with 20 life and having a guaranteed Vial Smasher.
It's a bit much.
A bit much is an understatement.
I mean, who doesn't want a Fire Blast for 10 damage?
Exactly.
Nixia played that couple of times, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just busted.
Yeah, it's
no,
so
fair, it's fair.
Sure.
Totally fair.
Igor.
I guess it's time for my commander.
Yeah, how about you?
Let's go with Derevi. I'm building a Derevi deck, but currently I'm missing most of my stack pieces because they're in all other decks. So I'm building some kind of stupid wizard something deck. Not sure how that's gonna go with, and tomorrow is the first trial. Because I'm meeting with my playgroup. And I managed to play against Tess, first against her dinosaurs, and then it was completely unfair because I just tapped her biggest possible attackers. And all that. And Tess got kinda salty when fighting against that. But as soon as she played Saskia, she was crushing me all the time because she had too much pressure.
Wow, Derevi stacks? No, that's a...
No. That's a really new concept, right?
I mean,
it was more of a Derevi Wizard Tribal type deck.
I'm currently kind of bored that train because I need to get more Armageddons and stuff.
Well, so, you and stacks is like me and Tron. You just try to find another way to stacks people.
Oh, definitely. I'll try to build stacks in every color besides mono white.
I'm actually of the opinion that Derevi, doesn't want to be playing Armageddon type effects. You would rather be building the deck with a low land count to maximize sort of the quality of your draws, just because Derevi doesn't generate card advantage herself. And then on top of that, you want to be running things like Winter Orb, which don't destroy lands, but are effectively cutting people off of them.
I'm playing Akatsuki, but I can't find my Winter Orb. I had it somewhere, but I'm not sure where it is.
Yeah, so it's a slightly different philosophy from Bloodpod. Bloodpod plays like 33 lands to Derevi's 30, which... You know, maybe it doesn't sound like a huge difference, but it actually adds up over the course of a long game.
I don't have all the mana rocks. I can't actually go with the CDH approach. I have to build it a bit more normal EDH-y.
What do you mean you don't have a Time Twister?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought everybody had like 3 of them.
Yeah.
I don't know. The only Derevi I played against was a Bird Tribal deck.
Yeah, but that's because our friend Yurai is a bit of a peculiar person.
Well, he does like birds.
He adores birds.
Just the way I adore worms. But hey.
That's a good segue, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because one qualm that Yurai and Niksha had is that which tribe is better, the birds or the worms?
No. Our biggest qualm was birds versus scarecrows. And when we found out that scarecrows indeed scare birds.
Okay, second biggest qualm is worms against birds. But worms never had a commander, right?
Actually, it wasn't worms versus birds, because if you recall, on our Facebook page, he issued an official challenge, his avatars versus my worms.
Oh yeah, that was the thing, I apologize.
So now that, you know, with Battlebond, I'll actually be ready to accept that challenge.
But how, Nick? There are no legendary worms.
Ho ho ho! That's what I thought. That's what I was prepared for. And going into Battlebond, this is the last set I ever expected to find a freaking legendary worm, everyone! It's here! It's possible! It's going to happen!
What this means is Niksha can finally stop bitching about legendary worms.
I mean, I did stop at some point.
Because
I lost all hope.
Each set that comes up, you bitch about why is this not a legendary worm, why is this a stupid legendary ape, and things like that.
Oh my god, you're referring to that stupid ape thing.
You mean the latest set that came out before this?
I'm
referencing that one.
I mean, come on, Amonkhet was basically Dune. How is there not a legendary worm on Dune?
You got like two worms and an enchantment.
I got a trash run common. Oh my.
But are we talking about Niksha's worm? Sorry, what?
Niksha likes his worms.
I'm collecting them. Currently, I'm like missing like three to have a full collection.
Three with this set coming out, or?
With this set, it's four.
And it's gonna be five because the anthology is coming out.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that one should be easy to acquire.
Yeah, it's just money wise, it's gonna be like. But Niksha, what does this worm say?
I'm sorry, Jesse, you had something to say?
Yeah, I was gonna say, so you're collecting worms with, from all the reprints as well?
Yeah, absolutely, every version.
Editions.
Every
okay.
version. I even have.
Dedication.
So currently I have six worm coils. So
oh,
I have a regular, regular foil, commander, pre-release foil, masterpiece, and the oversized player reward.
Nice.
And now we're gonna get, the one in anthology.
Yeah.
Right, we're getting a reprint of Wormcoil.
Yep, but let's get to the Niksha's favorite spoiler of all time.
So, the spoiler that made this officially the second best set ever made in Magic is Grothama All-Devouring. It's a 3-green-green, 10-8 legendary creature... Oh, I can't believe I'm actually saying this. A legendary creature worm that says other creatures have, whenever this creature attacks... You may have it fight Grothama All-Devouring. When Grothama leaves the battlefield, each player draws cards equal to the amount of damage dealt to Grothama this turn by sources they controlled.
It's a pretty sweet card.
It's a 10-8 for 5 mana.
And it's really weird all as well. Like, it's a really interesting build around me, but I'm not gonna build around it. I'm just gonna use it as a commander. The only build around me I'm going to do is include Stonehoof Chieftain, so I can attack with Grothama to make it indestructible and trample, and Stonehoof Chieftain, and then have the Chieftain fight with Grothama. They both survive because they're indestructible, and then you just play Conjurer's Closet and blink your Grothama and get 8 cards.
Wow.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah, that should be sweet.
Niksha wants to live a dream.
It'll happen eventually.
But sheesh, this is a strong card. It takes a lot to actually kill this guy in combat.
It's an interesting card, all right, because, I mean, yeah, the issue is that, I guess, leaves the battlefield trigger. You're going to either need to bounce it in green or else, you know, kill it yourself in combat if you want to abuse it to just draw a bunch of cards. Otherwise, it's kind of neat in the sense that, like, it has, like, some good play from your opponent's perspectives where, you know, they can just kind of... offer up some creatures as tribute to kill it. Obviously, like, getting 8 power worth of creatures and just, like, sending them right in is, like, not gonna happen very, very often. So a lot of the times this is just gonna be a 5 mana 10-8. But if I was building around it, I could definitely see either going the route that Nixia described or else using like pump spells as kind of like, you know, if a wild growth, it basically can turn into a ancestral recall, which is pretty interesting.
I mean, also you can put things like Helm of the Host on this guy.
Yeah.
And then draw all the cards.
Yeah, definitely. And sorry, I wasn't talking about wild growth. I was talking about giant growth. But yeah, that's just my my competitive side. It's one of these cards I play, and one of them I don't.
Another card I was thinking about, like, is this card ever going to be playable in anything in existence? And I finally found a reason why to play it. It's the, I think it's called Verdant Rebirth from Ixalan. The 2-mana instant in green. That says, if target creature would die this turn, return it to your hand instead. And you draw a card.
So you draw cards upon drawing cards.
Yes. And you get your worm back.
I think it's a bit iffy. It is what you say, it is the card.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a bit iffy.
Mm. Well, it's a way for you to get those cards, if you're gonna fight with your worms.
Why not play Reincarnation instead?
I don't know. Because I don't have it.
It should be easily to acquire. It was in Commander 2013.
I know.
In the pro deck.
It's really unfortunate that Grothama is mono green instead of being green black, just because black also I think has some decent worms, like Massacre Worm for example would be a great.
I mean, the best thing would be if this was every color besides blue.
Right.
Oh, but then you can't play Echoing Worm. Not Echoing. It was Warping Worm.
Blue does have some worms, yeah.
It does have two, in fact.
From a competitive perspective, this guy is not going to see play. Just really? Want to add that.
But Jesse, what about the coveted mid-range Bloodbot spot?
Oh, yeah, I mean, hey, it's 10 power for 5 mana. It's pretty reasonable.
Everything is going into the mid-range spot of Bloodbot.
What seems better to you, 1 mana 6/6 flying lifelink or a 5 mana 10/8? Nothing.
You could maybe draw cards.
Yeah, you can maybe draw cards.
Yeah, but overall, I'm actually quite happy that Nixia finally gets his worm in the legendary spot.
I'm happy for your worm, Nixia.
Yeah, I was at the point where, like, just make anything. Let it be colorless for all I care. But, yeah, I'm just not going to, like, complain about it being mono green. I just won't. That would be petty of me.
let it be colorless.
This turned out to be kind of a playable card, so Nixia's not going to complain.
I just want it to be colorless, so like literally the only worm you jam into it is Worm Coil Engine.
Worm Swamp.
And then people are like, wait, how did you play a second Worm Coil? And I was like, shut up. I'm playing all 6 of my Worm Coils.
No, you just play 60 of Worm Coils in 40 lands.
Yeah.
That's the plan.
That seems good.
That seems like an okay deck, yeah. It takes a while to get there, but...
But enough about this wild thing. Oh, one more interesting fact. Actually, when we get to the partner mechanic, I'll mention it. But, yeah, how about we get on to some actual cards from this set?
You mean actual good cards?
I said actual cards. Don't correct me, Igor.
Jesse, what is the first thing you want to talk about?
I mean... We can just start right from the beginning, if you want to start with Arena Rector.
Oh, of course.
What does it do?
When Arena Rector dies, you may exile it. If you do, search your library for a Planeswalker card, put it onto the battlefield, then shuffle your library. And otherwise, it's basically Academy Rector in terms of cost and stats. So I think it's 4 mana, 1/2. Yep. So yeah. So basically, you know, you get this into play, you get it to die, exile it. Obviously, you need to be able to apply that replacement effect. And then you cheat out a Planeswalker. And I think more often than not, we're looking at cheating out an Ugin. Or cheating out a Nicol Bolas if we're playing 4 colors.
Oh, so but which Nicol Bolas?
Which Nicol Bolas? That's a good question. I think I'm pretty partial to the new one myself. I mean, it's just a monster. I mean, they're both monsters. But I guess like the new Nicol Bolas is probably better 1v1 compared to the old one. Because the old one is going to just create so much advantage. By stealing permanents and stuff.
Let's put it this way. Turn 2, which Planeswalker do you want to have more?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I quite like Ugin personally just because it's colorless, which means that you're not stretching your mana base. And on top of that, you can board wipe, which is super important.
Yeah, Ugin is definitely a better option.
I'm kind of glad we finally got a good way to cheat in Tybalt into play.
Are we really going to do this now, Igor? Are we really going to talk about Tibalt?
Of course. What other Planeswalker do you want to cheat into play? I mean, this one is just too powerful.
No. I was thinking about the new Nissa. She's also really good with Arena Rector. The green-blue one.
I was going to ask which Nissa. But yeah, this is a cool card, and you can do a lot of silly things with it. Less silly things than with the Academy Rector, but...
Yeah, I think overall Academy Rector is going to be a little bit more powerful, just because, again, from a competitive perspective, there's not really any Planeswalkers that are, like, really going to close out games for you in a timely fashion. It's unfortunate. I mean, you know, the only two Planeswalkers that really see play are Teferi and... Well, sorry, there's three. There's Teferi, there's Tezzeret, and then there's Ugin. And more often than not, they're all in the same deck. So, and it's a mono-blue deck, so we're not going to see Arena Rector in that deck. And I mean, Atrax is really happy to see this deck in more casual circles. But this card, I should say. But what? Atraxa's, when is Atraxa not happy? There's always new tools.
Yeah. I was going to say, historically speaking, there's more enchantments than there's Planeswalkers. So just historically, you can get much more broken things.
Right. And also those enchantments, you know, cheating them into play lets you pull off all kinds of like weird convoluted combos. And yeah, so definitely there's a tendency for enchantments to have a higher potential for being broken.
Yeah, yeah, one of my favorite combos with enchantments is you get Omniscience and that's it. You would just win.
Yeah, Flash Rector and get Omniscience. That's a legit line of play.
So what next we're going to talk about?
Well, speaking of enchantments, we actually got a super cool reprint here. That was
Which one, though? Which one? Because I see two.
I'm talking about Doubling Season.
Ah, okay.
I think that Doubling Season is the more impactful reprint here.
Definitely, but...
Yeah, I mean, Land Tax is here, but, you know, Doubling Season. Unfortunately, at Mythic Rare, but hey, I'll take any reprint they make.
Which is funny, we have a Doubling Season just sitting in a binder, we never use it for anything.
I mean, I had a Doubling Season, I got rid of it because I got sick of playing Super Friends.
Mostly people around you got sick of you playing Super Friends.
No, it was completely me. It was my unfathomable generosity that I stopped playing Super Friends.
Niksha is a kind and a generous god.
Yes.
But yeah, Doubling Season is getting a reprint. Not much more to say about that, though.
Nope, I have nothing to add on that perspective other than it's about time. And, you know, it's such a casual favorite that I'm excited that people are going to get to have fun with that card.
So you all want to talk about Planeswalkers?
New cards.
So we have a pair of Planeswalkers. You were going to say, Niksha?
I was just going to ask, is it better to explain the new mechanic first or get to the new mechanic when we get to it?
I was actually going to start to say that we have these two new Planeswalkers, but they have something specific about them. So Niksha, explain us how does the partnering work in this set?
So in this set, we have kind of a new mechanic that says... A partner with then a specific name. So in the case of Will Kenrith, he says partner with Rowan Kenrith. And this means that when Will Kenrith enters play, you may have target player search their library for Rowan Kenrith and put it into their hand. What this means for Commander, however, is you can actually play those partners as your commanders, both of them, and they can't mix with any other. They have to be with their specific partner.
This is a good way to fix the Thymna and Thrasios problem.
Yeah, I was going to say, thank the Lord.
I mean, imagine if just Thymna and Tana had a partner with Thymna/Tana. That would fix a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, like, Bloodpot obviously is it's an interesting deck to, like, be the only sort of Thymna deck in the sense that it's such a good Thymna deck, and also like just the existence of Thymna itself kind of invalidates a lot of other bear strategies just because Thymna is so strong. So I think like Thymna and Thrasios themselves are a little bit more problematic, and even like the partners with mechanic would only go so far to reduce their impact on competitive play. I mean, not everybody necessarily agrees that they're problematic. I just think that they are sort of like at a power level that precludes, like, you know, exciting new designs from really coming out and shaking the meta in competitive EDH, which is my biggest issue with them. Not so much that they are that in and of themselves, like, too good or whatever. It's just that it's every new commander that gets printed has to sort of pass the Thrasios Timna test, which is like, do I want to play this? Is there any reason to play this over playing Thrasios and Timna? Maybe not.
Yeah.
And actually, there's another commander we're going to see later that's sort of a really good, I think, sort of a good example of that.
What I was going to say, while we read the abilities of the Planeswalkers, could we just do plus two of the first one and plus two of the second one, so we can see how well they interact?
Okay, you do the blue one, I'll do the red one then.
So, before we start reading, Will and Roman Kendrith are brother and sister, and my best guess is that spark ignited when they pushed the little kid off of their bedroom window. Because they look goddamn like Lannisters.
Indeed.
But yeah, Will Kendrith, 4 and a blue with 4 starting loyalty. His plus 2 is following. Until your next turn, after 2 target creatures each have base power and toughness and lose abilities.
0-3. Base power and toughness 0-3.
Sorry, I was just reading the text on the side. I was a bit confused. But 0-3s, yeah. They become 0-3s, and what does the Roman say, Mitch?
So, Roman Kenrith is a 4 and double red with 4 starting loyalty as well. For plus 2, during target player's next turn, each creature that player controls attacks if able.
So, they interact really well because you just pick 2 most dangerous things, and, you know, rest can swing at me.
Go on.
So, minus 2 is target player draws 2 cards. Until your next turn, instant sorcery and planeswalker spells that player casts cost 2 less to cast.
Rowan says, minus 2, Rowan Kenrith deals 3 damage to each tapped creature target player controls.
These two abilities don't interact that well together, they don't interact at all, but the minus 2 on Will is, it's kind of good.
Also, the plus 2 of Will interacts really well with minus 2 of Rowan.
Yep.
Because
that's,
you
know, a good synergy.
They attacked with something, and you make those 0-3 and then just kill them.
Yeah.
Right, I see a clear play pattern with these two commanders, which is, you know, ideally if you have both out, you're going to want to plus both, and then on the following turn use the minus from Rowan to, you know, wipe out a couple of creatures that just attacked that also now have 3 toughness. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in theory you could use Will again, or you could just draw 2 cards, which is absurd, and then play a bunch of stuff with this pretty steep discount. So Will's minus 2 is just kind of nuts.
Yeah. And we come to the ultimate. Target player gets an Emblem Wit. Whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell, copy it. You may choose new targets for the copy.
While Rowan says, for minus 8, target player gets an Emblem Wit. Whenever you activate an ability that isn't a mana ability, copy it. You may choose new targets for the copy.
And now you get the fun thing when you get Rowan's Emblem and you minus 2 with Will.
Yeah.
Everything is much cheaper. Plus you draw 4 cards, and I hear that's kind of okay.
And it's also really nice that you can distribute that among teammates. So in a 2-on-2, you can play like a mono blue Will deck and a mono red Rowan deck. That should turn out fun.
Oh my god.
It's also worth adding that these guys ultimate super quickly. Like, it's only going to take 3 turns if you assume that you're just able to tick them up safely. Which, you know, considering that their ultimates don't immediately win the game, is just going to, like, be miserable for the people you're playing against. Because, well, like, you're not going to lose, probably.
Plus, you're playing these two color combinations, blue-red, and you're going to have a lot of control effects. So your Planeswalkers might realistically get to ultimate.
Just one little note. They both have the line of text, Will Kenrith can be your commander. So it's not some rule they stated, it's actually on the card this time.
Yeah, just like Teferi had and all the other, that was what, Commander 14 commanders?
Yeah, I think it was.
And one good thing about this, these two Planeswalkers is, if you open one in the booster, you're going to get the other, which is pretty sweet. And second of all, the art on both cards is just basically from perspective one, then perspective of the other, but it's the same art.
To return to your Game of Thrones comment before, are we shipping these two? Or are we imagining that there's, like, seriously Lannister situation going on? Brother, sister, you know?
Whatever you want to do.
Okay, that's my headcanon now.
Let's make it a bit safer and say that they pushed Squee off of the window. So he gets better.
Or, you know, the guy from Stunning Reversal.
Oh, God.
They exiled him. Squee, a.k.a. Tyrion, a.k.a. I don't know.
What's next that's cool on the docket?
Is there some card you want to mention, Jesse?
So, I mean, if we're just going to go straight to it, I mean, the card that I find really intriguing this time around, and I mean, and there's a lot, it's a really cool set, but Najeela, the Blade Blossom.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, we maybe should have built up to this one, but here we are. So, whenever a warrior attacks, you may have its controller create a 1-1 white warrior creature token that's tapped and attacking. And then for a Wooburg, so a white, a blue, a black, a red, and a green, untap all attacking creatures. They gain trample, lifelink, and haste until end of turn. After this phase, there's an additional combat phase. Activate this ability only during combat. And otherwise, she's a 3-mana 3-2 with no keywords or anything like that.
Basically, Alesha.
Yeah, so she's got Alesha's stat line, exactly. Minus the first strike, which is pretty significant because it kind of figures into what Najeela is sort of trying to do. Now this card is nuts. I love the design of this card just because like it feels fundamentally red in the sense that like, yes, it's very combat focused. But then, you know, it has an ability that feels very white with the creating tokens. And then the fact that it's in five colors and like this, you know, like we're talking about what can be a crazy combo engine is just, it makes this feel like a five color design card. It's sort of like touching into every single one of those colors in its own unique way. So, you know, it's, yeah, from my perspective, like designing five colored cards is probably like one of the hardest things you can do because how do you sort of make it feel like it's all of those different colors? And this is a cool design from that perspective.
One of the things that people have already started saying is just put a sort of a feast and famine on her.
As far as combos go, yeah. So we're looking at basically, the most basic combos are going to be, okay, well, during combat, as long as I can untap five colors worth of mana and lands with something like a sort of Feast or Famine or like a Bear Umbra or something like that, then yeah, you're just going to get infinite combat steps, which is, you know, it's not all that much to ask for. The niche that this card has is that it's basically just going to provide a lot of inevitability in like an otherwise fair game of Magic. You don't have to really build your deck so much around this. You can kind of just play good cards. And like swords, you know, maybe they're not like the most incredible cards in competitive EDH, but like at the same time, they do provide a considerable amount of advantage, you know, as far as being able to let you play stuff in your first main phase and then untap your lands in your during combat and keep up interaction afterwards. So like these are reasonable cards, and you're not really like costing yourself anything as far as deck building goes, by including them. So Najeela is really interesting from that perspective just because like you can kind of just build her in so many different directions to make it work. From a competitive perspective, you can also kind of just build her as like I'm going to jam a lot of good cards in my deck. And as long as the game goes on long enough, I sort of have this inevitable win con right in the command zone that doesn't really ask for much. So yeah, I'm excited about this card. I don't think it's going to be like totally busted because again, it doesn't pass the Thrasios Tymna test, but yeah, it's neat. I love five color commanders.
One more cool thing is that she says whenever a warrior attacks, not the warrior you control.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get a little political. My warrior is going to attack, let's say, Steve. And then you can just say, oh yeah, screw Steve. Here, get a 1-1 warrior.
And in competitive, you know, usually you typically don't want to give your opponent's resources, but there are times where occasionally you do want to do that. So, I mean, it's not just trinket text to look at it from that perspective either. It can have an impact even in, you know, obviously in casual circles and in more competitive circles, it can have some kind of, it can mean something that you do that. I think Forbidden Orchard is a great example of that, where there's sort of this sub game where you have to decide who's getting the tokens, because a lot of the time you're going to need to like have your opponents block somebody else's Tymna, for example, you know, to return to that, that sort of now trope of competitive EDH play.
But yeah, Najeela is quite cool. Niksha, what do you like?
Well, I just wanted to point out that, from a casual perspective, Najeela is like the best warrior tribal commander.
Oh yeah.
Because she's red to cast, so she's easily castable, but you can include anything you want, and that's really cool.
Mm. I already have some ideas how I want to build her. I mean, for example, like it just makes so much sense to include cards in like every different color for her. You know, we have that new, well, we're going to get to it at a certain point, but a certain new black warrior, that's a sort of, you know, a very easy include in that deck. But then she also really likes equipment because, you know, obviously sort of Feast and Famine is reasonable, and things like Skullclamp are great because, well, she doesn't produce card advantage, but she does make 1/1s that die to Skullclamp. So that seems pretty good. you know, she just kind of like touches upon like every single color and wants like to draw something from that. You know, she even wants you to play Derevi in the deck because, like, that turns all of your creatures into something, combat triggers that are going to untap your lands and enable her ability. So she wants you to be playing, like, blue and green cards. She wants you to play mana dorks. Like, it's fantastic. Like, such an interesting design and one that really, again, captures those five colors in such a creative way.
I also like the fact that it says whenever a warrior attacks and not non-token warrior.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I'm actually looking for an excuse to play Brutal Hordeshift in any deck I can, so...
You know, you guys keep mentioning that line of text, but the one part of it that you have yet to mention is the fact that it doesn't say whenever one or more warriors attacks. It's whenever
also that, yeah.
Which is obscene. You know, yeah, like, you're going to get a ton of tokens, and they're going to grow exponentially.
She's a slam dunk.
So, another card I'm excited about is Bramble Sovereign. So, it's a 2 and a double green for a 4/4 creature dryad. Whenever another non-token creature enters the battlefield, you may pay 1 and a green. If you do, that creature's controller creates a token that's a copy of that creature.
Sheesh.
So, I mean, I don't know where to really start with this, but it's just a really... It's like a Riku of 2 reflections, only better, in a way.
Not legendary, though, but really efficient at a job.
It's like Riku of 1 reflection, yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. And it can get really political really fast. Especially when you throw in a doubling season or parallel lives or something like that.
Why? Why are you doing this to us?
But even if you're not going to get political and just copy your own things, it can get really stupid real fast.
I mean, and look at it as when you're playing a two-headed giant commander, the power level you can actually achieve with the Bramble Sovereign is actually really, really high because you're copying your teammates' creatures as well. That's that's not a thing you should overlook.
Definitely.
I think for competitive play, this is just a tad too slow. Definitely. But this is, like, for casual play, oh my goodness, this is such an engine. You're going to want to run this in a lot of casual green decks just because, like, it basically turns any of your enter the battlefield effects and, you know, it doubles them. It basically just, it's a huge resource engine, like a advantage engine in sort of like the mid and late game. And casual commanders sort of dominated by needing these, like, really powerful, impactful cards. So, yeah, so this is a slam dunk for sure.
You know what's interesting? For a price of a clone, which is a 2 and a blue, if you have Riku out, you can basically make 2 copies of creatures.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and again, that's going to be too mana intensive to do in anything but the most casual circles. But you know, pulling it off in casual is going to be, like, a lot of people are going to get very frustrated with this card. I can see it.
And that's why you pack more removal, and that's it.
Yeah. Don't leave home without it, kids.
Yeah, play more spot removal. We always say that, and, you know, people don't play it enough.
My only problem with it is that it costs a lot of green to do things, so I really can't fit it into Scarecrows, because I want to play my Scarecrows for free, so I have the mana to, you know, double them up. So, you know, double the Scarecrows, double the Vindicates, double the fun.
You say fun, but...
it's fun. I can, you know, Scarecrows are kind of a text deck because they can blow up lands, I guess. But they're not fast enough to start blowing up lands that early.
Yeah. Right. And it's unclear that this is better than, I guess, the typical Scarecrow line of just kicking Rite of Replication.
I don't do that.
Yet. He doesn't do that yet.
He doesn't do that yet. Yeah, you just need to beat him with Thymna a little bit more and then he might learn his lesson.
Okay.
I mean, I am going to put the Helm of the Host in the deck, because, you know, having more than one Reaper King is nice.
Ugh, that's gross.
Put Najila so you can get more Reaper Kings coming into play.
Sure.
What I was going to say, want to talk about the Stunning Reversal?
Go ahead.
3 and a black, it's an instant. Next time you would lose the game, this turn instead draw 7 cards and your life total becomes 1. Exile Stunning Reversal.
It's nice, actually.
It's cool.
It's a really cool card.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of people, I think, are looking at this in the competitive community, and they're saying, like, oh, I could do some silly things with this and, like, Ad Nauseam, where I can basically, like, you know, Ad Nauseam, run out of life, and then this will trigger And I'm just like, that just seems so much worse than things you could be doing, like Angel's Grace plus Ad Nauseam, which is basically the same thing, but for 6 mana. Yeah, so this is an interesting card. And I don't know, like a lot of mythics that have kind of like weird, kooky out there designs that are very complex, I'm not sure that like anyone has necessarily found a good home for it just yet. But it's an interesting one, and I'm sure it's going to be like a blowout in like plenty of in casual decks where like someone's just going to run this card because they think it's hilarious, and they're going to get to cast it the one time that they have it and the one time that it's relevant, and it's going to be incredible.
Well, it combos well with, I mean, combos well is a really strong word, but it combos with I forgot what it's called, the 3 mana end the turn.
Right.
Oh, Glorious End.
Glorious End, yeah. Mm-hmm. You see, you're at 40, you cast Glorious End, and you get to get, and then you get to drop your health to 1.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. That's great. And you're just gonna pass and a get turn 7
cards. And get 7 cards, which is more important.
Yeah. I'm gonna put that one right up on the wall, like on my poster board that says bad combos.
I mean, I just wanted to highlight this because it's a really cool card. Not necessarily a good one, but a really cool card.
But very cool.
But I did hear some talking about it being actually kind of almost legit in Legacy.
What does kind of almost mean?
I don't know. People are considering it. That's like good enough, right? It can.
I mean, draw 7 is insanely strong. Mm-hmm. I mean, the issue with it is that it's 4 mana and
It's not Ad Nauseam.
Right. And I mean, like, again, it doesn't impact the board and it's going to sit and rot in your hand. Unless you put yourself into a position where you're specifically losing. Like, this is not the type of card, like, a lose less card in Legacy is not what I want. I really just want to be able to, trade 1-for-1 with opponents, occasionally get a 2-for-1. And, I mean, obviously this is like a huge amount of card advantage, but unless I'm like specifically comboing it with something that's going to like get my life total down quickly, and then I'm going to draw 7 cards, and from there I'm going to sort of storm off and win. I'm not particularly interested in this, but then again, I play mostly fair decks in Legacy, so yeah, this is, you know, I don't want to be in a position where I'm down to 1 life.
Yeah. Next card?
Well, speaking of Legacy, we have a really cool reprint in True Name Nemesis.
Oh my god.
This is such an obvious segue, it hurts my brain.
it's such a fair card.
So we got the True Name Nemesis, and this time it's going to be available in foil.
Oh my goodness.
Also, it's finally in a set. It's all again in a set where it doesn't do anything as broken.
Yeah, it's a genius place for a reprint.
Yeah, because you have 2 opponents, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm somebody who plays True Name Nemesis and Legacy in like a Stoneblade deck, so with Stoneforge Mystic and equipments and stuff like that, and yeah, so I love the card, and but you know, it's such a boogeyman of the format, so people naturally, they have fair gripes with this card, I understand it.
Niksha?
Yes?
Is this the reason why they made that whole change that you have to declare which person you're attacking in Two-Headed Giant like a month or two ago?
Wait, they did?
Yeah, that was the whole judge ruling thing. In Two-Headed Giant, you have to announce whom are you attacking.
I think that you had to declare that anyways, because of cards like some dragons and other cards that says that when they deal damage to a player, they do something.
I know that at the beginning of Dominaria pre-release, that was a specific thing that they said that changed.
Hmm.
So things like Baron worked much less good in Two-Headed Giant.
I mean, sure. Okay. So, yeah, because... no, this is weird. I can't remember if True Name Nemesis actually worked, like, before. Wait, let me... Does this mean that land walking doesn't work anymore?
It doesn't. It does if you attack a specific player with those lands, I think.
Because before, if you could attack anyone... Yeah, before you could attack anyone, because if any of them had, like, an island, you had Island Walk. It was true, so you could attack any player. And, okay, then this then makes... Huh. I actually don't know if it works for Island Walk.
There was, in fact, a change, and the change is that, as Igor pointed out, basically you are declaring a specific defender at this point from the opposing team, so you're attacking somebody specifically, whereas before you used to attack the team. So it is exactly as you described, Previously, what you would do is you would attack the team, and then for resolving effects that cared about who you were attacking, you need to figure out who the defending player was, which is individually, which is, you know, obviously not intuitive functionality for combat triggers.
Okay, good to know that, I guess. But except for a true name Nemesis, anything else some of you want to mention?
As far as reprints or new cards?
No, anything.
Reprints, I mean, there's Nirkana Revenant, which is an important one.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was like $25.
Yeah, but it was one of those that's expensive just because of the small supply.
Definitely, but now you're going to get a bit more of supply.
Right, and expensive too, because who doesn't like running two Crypt Ghasts?
You just make sure that nobody has any swamps to play with, and you're good.
That is a line of play, I must agree.
One reprint that I'm happy about, but doesn't make anybody that, you know, much thrilled, is Nixitid, just because of our friend Nixitid who goes to town blog, a.k.a. Peter.
Hey, foil Nixitids.
Basically, but what I actually wanted to talk about were two partners, Virtus the Veiled and, what's his name, Gorm the Great.
Let me just find them.
So, Virtus the Veiled is a 2 and a black assassin. He's an Azra assassin, whatever that is, besides a Croatian rock band. he has Death Touch. He's a 1-1, but he's partnered with Gorm the Great. So the whole thing that we had the Planeswalkers still applies. Whenever he deals combat damage to a player, that player loses half-life rounded up. That's okay. But Gorm the Great is here to make sure that he actually gets through, because he's a legendary warrior for 3 and a green, a 2-7 vigilance, partnered with Vitrus the Veiled. And he must be blocked if able, and Grom must be blocked by 2 or more creatures if able. And a cool thing about this art is that Vitrus the Veiled has sickles of some kind as weapons, but Gorm, he's carrying 2 huge shields, basically just pushing people away so Vitrus can kill him.
I mean, Gorm is kind of a noob, because, you know, you don't actually stack the defense points of dual-wielding tower shields.
Actually, in Dark Souls, you can actually have 2 huge shields as a weapon. I think it's Dark Souls 2.
But this is the company that made D&D.
Ah, damn it.
I was thinking of Dark Souls 2 for what it's worth. This reminds me so much of those enemies. I can't remember if it's Dark... I think it's Dark Souls 3, where you have to... I can't remember, though. It's been a little while since I've played them. Where you have to get past those guys, you know, holding up the 2 giant shields in, like, the kind of, like... catacombsy type area, and it's basically, they're basically Gorm.
Basically, yeah. And Gorm is here to make sure that Vitrus the Veiled hits, and I'm really looking forward to get like a couple of these, both partners. Tess is gonna play this in Saskia, I think, so, you know, all your dudes can actually hit harder with Saskia, because Gorm needs to be blocked. And if Vitrus gets to hit somebody, you know, why not?
This is a very interesting card, Gorm, mm-hmm. I mean. Mm-hmm. I think, like, the text is, it's not super clear to parse it, just because it has to be blocked, but then also it has to be blocked by 2 or more creatures if able, which basically just means that, like, it's gonna absorb so many blockers. Mm-hmm. Yes, but then the nice thing about it is, for people who have played against Teneos and Kiro, they're gonna understand that that stat line, 7 toughness,
yep.
You know, 7 versus 8, it's huge. Like, you're not swinging through that. Plus, it has vigilance.
Yep.
So, oh my goodness, like, this guy is, he really, like, feels like a wall.
And there is one more thing I like about this. This is a Golgari deck, basically, if you play them together. That's not centered about the graveyard.
But by assassinating people.
I like that. Because this whole set is about, you know, glorious combat in the arena. This is basically MMA for that play.
Yeah, and there's a lot of references to that throughout the set.
We'll get to those.
Also, another thing about the partner mechanic. So, if you're not playing them as your commander, your partners basically have draw a card, and that's like draw a specific card, and that's actually really good.
That's why I said Tess is gonna play this in Saskia, because you get one other is here.
Yeah, no, that's a very fair point. They both basically tutor a specific card, and it's generally going to be better than a random draw, so that's quite strong.
Tutor a specific creature for 2 or for 3 or 4 mana is kind of okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, plus it also leaves behind a body that does something and is going to do a lot more when you play the part you just tutored for. So, yeah, these are quite strong. I mean, again, from a competitive perspective, you're not going to start devoting deck slots to that. But in casual, yeah, they provide so much value.
Mm. And just put quite a spike on Vitreous Veil so you can take even more life points of enemies.
Oof. You just got peanut butter in my jelly.
Okay.
Anything else anybody wants to say about these two partners?
Not really. Pretty much no. Everything was said.
Moving on to some other partner?
Yeah. The one I want to talk about is because they're going to make a whole new deck archetype. Are Zinnersfl Eye of Wisdom. And
see, I would have expected this to be easy for you to pronounce as a Croatian person, but actually there's not enough ch's and s's in there.
Basically.
Zinderspult Eye of Wisdom and Okaun Eye of Chaos. So,
yeah.
Zinderspult is 4 and a blue for a 1/4 legendary creature homunculus that partners with Okaun. Okaun? It's Okaun, right?
Okaun, yeah.
Okay. At the beginning of combat on your turn, flip a coin until you lose a flip. Whenever a player wins a coin flip, draw a card. While Eye of Chaos says, at the beginning, it's also 4 and a red for a 3/3. At the beginning of combat on your turn, flip a coin until you lose a flip. Whenever a player wins a coin flip, double Okaun's power and toughness until end of turn.
Sheesh.
So, it's a coin flip tribal.
Yeah.
If you just get one or two lucky coin flips with the Eye of Chaos, he gets bold.
So I fully expect these guys to be incredibly popular in casual Commander just because, definitely. Like, you have that one person in every playgroup who loves Chaos and is going to love to play this type of Commander, both for the blue and the red Chaos cards, as well as the fact that they are inherently chaotic. Additionally, these guys do have an infinite combo with them, which I'm not sure if you two have looked up or have heard of yet, but there's
which one?
There is
Frenetica
that one.
Freet.
Yeah, oh, Frenetica Freet.
Yeah, zero mana, flip a coin.
That's why it spiked.
Yeah. Yep. Now, the interesting thing about that is, as far as I know, it's unclear whether or not you'll be, you know, called out for slow play if you actually try to resolve all of those coin flips, which you have to, right? You have to resolve them. And if you want to draw basically your entire deck, which I would imagine is kind of the idea, well, it's a non-deterministic amount of coin flips. So you're just going to have to literally flip all those coins. You can't shortcut it. It's, I mean, I'm so glad that there's not good creature tutors in blue and red. And also the card pool in blue and red is like a tiny, tiny bit shallow for competitive play. So hopefully I won't actually have to deal with this a whole lot. But, you know, good luck to you guys.
I mean, these both commanders have a lot of mana, and they require a specific thing to do, you know, its thing, and then maybe win, if there is no interaction. So if you die to that, sure, fine, that's okay.
Yeah, and also, I mean, it's interesting because you're still going to need, if you want to do that even in a casual deck, because presumably, like, you're going to be putting on just a ton of triggers on the stack. And if an opponent has removal, then you basically need to respond by, like, just filling the stack with, like, a million copies to be guaranteed that you're going to draw your deck, right? And that requires you to be playing a card like Flash. So you can, like, Flash in Laboratory Maniac and then, like, draw cards and win at instant speed. So, you know, if we see, like, casual decks running Flash and doing broken things with it, I'll feel very vindicated.
I mean, this takes a lot of work to work.
It does, yeah. It's not going to be super competitive. But But the fact that this buyout has occurred, you know, it does mean that there's people interested in trying to make Frenetic Freed work. So we're probably going to see it plaguing casual play groups.
That's fine. Want to talk about more partners?
I have a card I want to talk about after the partners, but yeah, I'm down to talk about a couple more partners here.
We have Karav the Unredeemed. For 4 and a black, it's a legendary demon, partner with Regna the Redeemer, and it's a 3/3 with simple text. A blue, black, sacrifice X creatures, target player draws X cards and gains X life, put X +1/+1 counters on Karav the Unredeemed. So, just alone, he's a stack output for a huge number of dudes. And he can draw a card, which is nice, but what does Regna the Redeemer do?
Regna the Redeemer is a 5 and a white, 4/4 legendary creature angel that partners with Krav, has flying, and at the beginning of each end step, if your team gained life this turn, create 2 1/1 white warrior creature tokens.
Yeah, this is really nice because they fuel each other. And it's really unusual to see an angel and demon work together, but I guess in the pits, strange bedfellows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the story, they're actually lovers.
Oh my god, this is even cooler.
Because
that's why he's standing in front of her and protecting her.
Because in Ragna's Sanction, we'll get to that later, maybe, the flavor text, show them the light, my love, by Krav.
Sheesh. This is cool.
Very strange bedfellows.
Yep.
I mean, I like the these weird nods to things.
Yeah, like Krav is unredeemed and he's like unredeemable, but Ragna will still try to redeem him.
Because love and all that.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of cute.
I don't know how appropriate this is, but if you look at the art, Krav is like really freaking huge compared to Ragna.
I mean,
that's kind of like, it's a little strange.
He got all those plus one counters on him. That's why he's so huge.
True.
And you can do anything with enough loops. You were referring to that, and we all know it.
I mean, I did preface my comment with, I don't know how appropriate this is, but...
I mean...
But get your mind out of the gutter.
Never.
They're very cool. I do like the fact that they're synergistic between themselves, and more importantly, I like the fact that they're drawing you cards. Because, you know, drawing cards is my favorite thing to do in this whole game.
And it's a really cheap stack outlet. Just one black any number of dudes.
Mm. That often is going to be two, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have enough of things, that's just going to grow and grow and grow. But the nice thing that the angel gives you, just the stack fodder.
Right. And you're probably going to be playing all kinds of other token synergies, like Bitter Blossom and stuff like that. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also... You know, it's also,
a pretty big draw.
Yeah,
it's at the beginning of each end step, so you can just sack them one by one and keep multiplying them.
And draw cards, gain life. Draw cards, gain life. It's almost like a thing Zidru, but actually efficient.
Draw some cards, gain some life.
Yep. Next part was the angel and the dragon. I think are the next.
Is there a lot to say about these two, though? Really?
We just have to mention them because they're new.
Limited bombs.
So, Sylvia, Bright Spear for 2 and a white, it's a 2-2 flyer, and... No, it's not even a flyer.
Nope.
Is it?
It's a knight.
Yeah, it's not
by... It's kind of a flyer.
Yeah,
we'll get to that. But this is the cheapest angel, I think, yet. This is not an angel, this is a human knight. I just got it as an angel for some reason. Sorry. It's the human knight, I apologize. But Sylvia has a double strike, and dragons on your team have double strike. So what does the dragon do?
So, Korvath, Bright Flame, is a 5 and a red 3-4 flying and haste dragon that partners with Sylvia, and says knights your team control have flying and haste.
It's a bit small as a 3-4 for 6 mana, but when Sylvia gives it double strike, it's a bit different.
Right. I guess, I'm not super excited because it's just another, combat-centric Boros commander.
Yeah.
That's been done so many times that it's just, not the most interesting design for me. But in actual, limited play, I think these are going to be fairly strong.
Oh, limited, you're really good with this.
Yeah.
Anything out of it, though?
Not through.
No, that's just it. rip Boros. When are we going to get a good commander for Boros?
Is this all the partners?
These are all the legendary partners.
Yeah.
We did miss one pair. We missed Toothy, I believe it was. And I can't remember. And Pyr, or Purr.
Toothy Pyr. And Pyr, yeah.
So what does Toothy do?
Toothy? Toothy is a 3 and a blue for a 1/1 legendary creature illusion. That partners with Pyr, and whenever you draw a card, put a +1/+1 counter on Toothy, and when Toothy leaves the battlefield, draw a card for each +1/+1 counter on it.
I love the flavor of this card.
Yeah.
I just love the fact that it's this little kid's imaginary friend. It's just adorable.
It is. And even the imaginary friend, it's adorable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very cute. Very scary, but adorable in its own right.
Now that we actually come to this card, what do you guys think about the art style of the set? Because some people have been bitching about it.
I mean, it's a little all over the place, even discounting cards that are reprints, mm-hmm. I find. Like, a lot of the cards, feel great. They feel normal, like your typical, painted with some CGI effects after, sort of some computer filters applied after, just to, you know, make it pop. But then, like, some of the art really feels like it was just sort of overdone on the computer. So it's like a little all over the place in that respect. Like, some of the art is great, really evocative, you know, nice chroma, like tons of super nice color. And then other art just happens to feel like it feels very flat. Like the new lands in particular, like some of those. And if you see them like blown up in particular, they don't look fantastic. If you ask me, they look like Bountiful Promenade, for example, like it's not super exciting to me. But then, you know, by comparison, Sea of Clouds looks great. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see the brush strokes, right? Like, that's so important.
Only complaint I had was that Spire Garden looks too much like, what is the Shockland? Stomping Grounds. It looks too much like Stomping Grounds.
Yeah, that's fair. I see.
But yeah, what do you think about these two commanders, Pir and Tuti?
Wait, what does Pir even do?
Oh yeah, we didn't mention him. Jesse, wanna take him?
Sure. So Pir is a 3-mana 1/1 in green. It's a 2 colorless and a green. If one or more counters would be put on a permanent your team controls, that many plus one of each of those kinds of counters are put on that permanent instead. So obviously you have immediate synergy with Tuti, who is going to be, you know, getting plus one counters and then doing the, your typical squid thing of dying and drawing you cards. but then on top of that, he has additional synergy with other types of permanents that care about counters. So there's like a lot of directions you can actually take this deck as far as plus one counters are concerned, or, you know, with some super friends type themes, charge counter type themes. So it's actually really, it's a cool design. From a competitive perspective, doesn't quite get there, again, but, you know, the bar is extremely high for us. I could definitely see playing these guys, either alongside Varel or like with Varel in the 99 or the 98, I should say.
Atraxa?
Or an Atraxa. Definitely could see it there. All dependent on the type of stuff you're trying to do with Atraxa. The thing with Atraxa is that your card pool is so huge and there's so many good cards to run that it's like, okay, do I want to run these two cards like over something else? You know, it's just everything fits into Atraxa, first world problems.
And that's why you don't play them in Atraxa. You actually find a friend and make him play Pir as their commander.
Oh, God.
And then you play 2-on-2. And then you get the best of both worlds.
Right.
Yeah, I think that the intended purpose is to play this in teams. So,
which raises an interesting question. I mean, if you're actually playing two-headed giants, like, let's say, a pre-release or like a draft for this set, when you open these partners, I mean, do you want to put both of them in your deck? Do you want to put one in your opponent's deck? You know, like, these are interesting deck building questions that you need to sort of ask yourself at the time. And it's relevant because obviously, like, if you put it in your opponent's deck, if you play one card, they might be able to play the second half immediately because they'll have mana available. But then it kind of like directs them towards building a particular color or colors. So there's like, I'm imagining a lot of different permutations for deck building that are going to be possible because, you know, you could be playing like green, red, running Pur in your pool when your opponent is playing blue, white, and they put Tuti in their deck, right? Because the way the partner works is that it's any player can go get the other half from their deck. It's not just you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be fun. Like, I'm really looking forward to seeing how that actually plays out. I think it's going to make for some really interesting deck building and gameplay choices.
Definitely.
It's gonna be fun when you're playing something like Grom and things like that. And you target your friend who you know that has something, who has Vitreous in his deck in the 99, because you have these two as partners. That could be interesting.
Yeah, and like there's so much sort of just incidental synergy, like just like from like type lines, like the creature type lines, and then like other cards in the set, that it's going to make for some really cool combinations. You know, just the fact that like Virtu is his second half, his partner is a warrior. You know, obviously, like, opens up warrior synergy if you're building that into your other deck and stuff like that. So all of these themes overlap in, like, a really, really nice and satisfying way. They really knocked this set out of the park, I have to say, from a variety of perspectives.
These partners are way less clunky. Not clunky, less damaging than the first partners were, but they learned a lesson, I guess. They learned their lesson.
Well, you know, did they learn their lesson, or do they just not necessarily care about competitive EDH play? I think it's sort of a bit of column A, a bit of column B.
I think it's more of a they wanted to do partners again, but if they just put normal partners in normal partner, it makes even more decks possible, and who knows what broken thing can you do that way. This way it's contained, it's limited, and it works nice and elegantly.
I agree. This is a much, much safer way to do partner in general. And overall probably would have been a great way to do it in the first place.
But again, lessons learned.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay, I think we're done. Yeah.
Actually, I just wanted to mention something about these partners. Not really partners, but related to them. So the only legendary creatures in this set that don't have partners are Najeela and Grothama. For Najeela, it was probably because, like, she doesn't need a partner. She can win this on her own.
No, Niksha, where do you put the partner text?
I mean, they could fit it without the... Well, you see on Rowan and Will Kenrith, it fits.
Uh-huh. No, you just put the anime death text on her, that font.
I think just partners with sort of Feast and Famine would have been great.
Oh my god!
But on Grothama, it makes sense, because Grothama probably ate its partner.
Because it's all devouring.
I mean, Grothama probably reproduces asexually, so yeah, I mean...
I think that Grothama is basically your Magandaro of this world. It's going to devour everything.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, how can you be like a 10-8 giant worm that's, you know, presumably been around for a very, very long time, be all devouring, and like somehow there's still things that exist on your plane?
they just throw bait at you. That's the thing. Just Oh my god. Oh my god.
It's the Tyranid problem, you know. They show up and they destroy everything, and then there's nothing left.
Maybe Kurosama like wakens only when the games begin or something like that.
So every weekend.
This is a planet where I think they just, or a plane where they basically just have games constantly, as far as I understand.
Or maybe they have games to decide who gets to be, you know, Grothama's food for that cycle.
Wow, what? The winner gets sacrificed or the loser gets sacrificed?
Both.
It's the Hunger Games.
Oh god. Okay, oh, now that we've done partners, let's talk about single cards that we are interested in.
Oh yeah, so there's a couple that I'm very interested in.
You had one, right?
Niksha?
No, Jesse, you said you had one.
I have two.
Oh, go ahead.
If you don't mind me taking the stage here. So the first one I want to talk about, because, well, it's going to be a lot simpler, I think, to get everything in here, is a Mind Blade Render, which is for one and a black, a 1/3 warrior. And whenever your opponents are dealt combat damage, if any of that damage was dealt by a warrior, you draw a card and you lose one life. So this card, I'm excited about this card. Did anybody want to say anything before I get into it?
No.
I like this card so much.
Yeah, I know you do too, because you play Bloodpod and you play Alesha as well. Yeah. But this card might actually see competitive play, and I wouldn't be surprised to see it see competitive play, just because, you know, we're always interested in an efficient, you know, in terms of mana, draw engine or value engine. Especially now, as the meta has sort of turned and taken like a very grindy turn, where everyone's playing like these Timna decks, where, you know, you're drawing cards and playing a lot of counter spells and kind of like not necessarily rushing to combo off, just kind of trying to disrupt your opponents. And this card is almost like a second Dark Confidant or a second Bob, because, you know, the stat line means it's going to have enough toughness to attack through most of the really common creatures in competitive EDH. Additionally, you know, it's very common in competitive EDH for people to not have like any creatures out, just because they're playing, you know, very like spell based combo decks. So yeah, so a lot of the time you're going to be able to get through with it, and you'll get to draw your one extra card per turn, which is, you know, pretty standard, you know, for a 2-mana draw engine. And then, you know, you're just going to be riding the gravy train.
What I'm looking forward to is playing this in Alesha and having Timna and the Ruin Raider in this card out and just hitting somebody.
Oh, yeah, and that's the thing. You're going to be playing this in your Timna decks and drawing, like, two cards off of it a turn. It's so good.
Just give me all the cards.
Yeah, and we just love having efficient draw engines like this. You probably don't replace Dark Confidant with this, but, you know, you're very likely going to play them alongside each other.
I wish I had Dark Confidence.
Yeah, it's a little expensive is the thing, but this is going to make at the very least, it's a great substitute for Dark Confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it can be tricky to find card slots, so it remains to be seen whether or not people are going to be playing this as well as Dark Confidant. I know I'm going to try to jam both in some of my more grindy decks. And again, the fact that it has three toughness means it's not going to get easily blocked by mana dorks or opposing Timnas. I mean, Timna blocks it, but it doesn't trade. And if your opponent is specifically holding their Timna back to block your Mindblade Render, well, you're pretty happy about that because it means that they're not necessarily swinging in with as much stuff. And they're sort of limiting their card draw capability in that respect. So, I think in terms of actual play pattern, this card is gonna be quite good. Even if it, looks even if you don't necessarily see it at the surface, it's gonna play out quite well.
Nick, so what do you think?
I mean, it's fine, I guess.
Well, in casual, it's gonna get outclassed very quickly.
No, it's just, it looks at warriors, and I'm more of a ninja kind of person, so yep. I don't really pay that much heed to this one.
But it itself is a warrior, right? So it triggers from its attacking at the very at a bare minimum.
Doesn't fit the ninja flavor though. So can't really play it.
Only problem I have this for my Alesha that Alesha is the only warrior it seems in the deck.
Other than this.
Yeah, that's kind of. But then again, I have constant access to Alesha, so.
Yeah, exactly. And this is going to be enough on its own to trigger itself. The interesting thing about this, however, is that it doesn't care about your warriors. It cares about any warriors. So, if your opponents happen to be playing this card too, well, there's going to be this sort of really sort of bad anti-synergy between them where your opponents are going to get to draw cards off of your attacks. And I mean, you get to draw cards too, but, that it feels less good to let your opponents draw cards. Be pulling it.
On the other hand, a lot of creatures are randomly warriors. That's the thing.
And just to mention, there is no drawback to this card. Only you can draw a card.
Yeah, but if two people have Mindblade Renders, then you know.
Oh, but I mean, okay, but whatever.
Yeah.
You draw cards. You don't really care about them. About them, don't you?
The thing is, they'll draw cards too if you both have Mindblade Render out and somebody takes damage from a warrior source.
Yeah.
Because it's. So, I mean, that's the thing. You still get to draw the cards, but it's less good when your opponents are drawing cards too.
Yeah. Just a side note, you know who's also a warrior? Boulder Intimidator. He's the best warrior ever. Because of that whole cowards can't block warriors line.
Yeah. That's a great design.
I first read it when I was playing game for a couple of games, a couple of years only. I read the card and I thought this was just a statement because, that's a factual statement. Yeah, why would cowards block warriors? Then I read the card, I was like, oh, I'm an idiot.
But earlier about, oh, sorry to interrupt, go ahead.
No, I was finishing up.
Okay, well, I was going to say earlier we had mentioned Najeela and how there's a certain warrior in this set that is going to immediately fit into that deck. And this is it. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, having Najeela in the command zone, getting, your 1-1 from this attacking, drawing a card from this attacking, that's a ton of value. And then, once you start getting your 1-1s, well, I mean, you can just start attacking with them instead. You obviously aren't going to be drawing, multiple cards just because of the way this is templated. However, you are going to generally have enough warriors to make sure you can connect. And this fits the bill for a very efficient draw engine that you would want to be running in a lot of decks anyway. So I see this card being quite popular.
What was the second card you wanted to talk about?
So the other one, this is the really exciting one, Spellseeker. So for two colorless and a blue, when Spellseeker enters the battlefield, you may search your library for an instant or sorcery card with converted mana cost 2 or less, reveal it, put it into your hand, then shuffle your library. And it's a 1-1. 1-1 human wizard. So this is basically Recruiter of the Guard, but for instants and sorceries. And my goodness, does this card open up some really interesting lines. And I don't even think we've fully figured out everything that this card could enable.
I mean, Flash?
Yeah.
Dramatic Reversal?
Oh, yeah.
Rift, all those things?
I mean, if, basically, if at minimum.
If you're playing Vintage and Seth Recall.
Jesus. Jesus. So that's the thing. In Vintage, we're talking about a 3-mana 1-1, so maybe you're not as excited about it just because you still have other tutors and stuff like that. But where this deck, or where this card really shines is, as you correctly pointed out, in sort of decks that either don't have the same tutor density because they're not running black, or else like decks that are running like a creature based combo where this can either fit into like, you know, a flash Protean Hulk pile, to, you know, let's say get something like a reanimate. So you can reanimate Protean Hulk and then like, you know, get another six CMC worth of creatures and presumably combo off. But additionally, you know, there's like all this unexplored potential with like, you know, even like birthing pod lines and stuff like that. You know, you're playing a creature, it leaves a body behind, and it gives you some value. That's exactly what we want. And the fact that it gets a card type that in general is going to be a lot more powerful than a creature is huge. So yeah, this is a card I'm very excited about. Immediately, like, I can see a home for it in competitive EDH in a few different decks, but the one I'm most excited to try it out in is again the like Flash plus Protean Hulk type decks, where you know, it does turn your line into like a two mana plus one black line, so a 3 mana I win the game line, which is like, you know, from a casual perspective, that's absurd already. But you know, by competitive standards, 3 versus 2 mana can make a kind of a big difference. But it's still going to be very efficient. And the fact is that it either fits into your pile, your first, Protean Hulk trigger, or it gets you flash to enable your other piles. Like, it's so absurd.
Any thoughts, Nixon?
It's a wizard, and you know what that means.
Inala? Or Drey?
Naban.
Oh, yeah! Oh, crap.
Oh, Naban. Yeah, Naban.
It actually works with Naban.
So you get two spells.
You get two.
Sheesh. That's value. And the curve works out too, right? Because Naban is a 2-drop.
Yep.
So you play him on 2 and you play this on 3. That's pretty cool.
Also, yeah. If you're going with Dim scenarios, have it in an Ala, have Naban out and then copy this guy.
Oh boy. That's called value.
Magical Christmas Land. Here we come.
Yeah. So yeah, this card is definitely going to see competitive play. And again, it remains to be seen just in how many places it's going to be fit. So I'm excited about this card. And I won't go into too much detail about all the CEDH lines with it because, well, that's not the point of the show. And I think we have plenty more stuff to cover still.
I mean, Niksha, what cards are you interested in?
Well, definitely Arcane Artisan. Artisan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a 2 and a blue for a 0/3 creature human wizard that says for 2 and a blue and you tap it and target player draws a card, then exiles a card from their hand. If a creature card is exiled this way, that player creates a token that's a copy of that card. When Arcane Artisan, leaves the battlefield, exile all tokens created with it at the beginning of the next end step.
You can just do the things with this.
There's a lot of potential for this. I mean, you can do silly things with it, you can get political and make other people do silly things with it, or your teammate can do silly things with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, silly things all around.
Shenanigans.
Yeah. So this card is really neat because sort of like at minimum, it's almost like an Elvish Piper.
Yeah.
And like a very weird, very blue Elvish Piper. But then the fact that it's also drawing you a card at the same time is kind of really neat. And then, yeah, so it's a pseudo loot effect, but like you're looting a creature into exile that then becomes a token. You know, if this didn't have the obvious glaring weakness that like you lose the tokens when it dies, it would be absurd. But
I mean,
as it stands,
of course you lose it when it dies.
Yeah.
Because
well, it would be too good. I mean, it is a mythic.
Mm-hmm.
It is a 0/3, but yeah. It's a 0/3, and it will have summoning sickness. So, like, mm-hmm. if you really wanted to push it, you could maybe. No, there's no universe where, like, I guess the tokens don't get exiled just because otherwise it's too good with things like Emrakul and whatnot.
Light Steel.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
you know.
I could see it really easily fit into a deck that plays blue, green, and white, because you can just, as your first one, you can put in Shalai, Voice of Plenty.
Oh god.
And then it has Hexproof.
Oh god. Oh god.
You can also put an Archetype of Endurance to give it Hexproof
that.
Too.
Yeah.
You know what's a card I wanted to talk about? Coming back to the coveted, let's call it mid-range bot spot, Archon of the Valor's Reach. For 4 and a green white, it's an Archon with Flying Vigilance and Trample, 5/6. As it enters the battlefield, choose Artifact, Enchantment, Instant Sorcery, or Planeswalker. Players can cast spells with a chosen type.
I find this card very exciting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but, choose what you're playing against. Sorcery, enchantment, whatever?
Yeah. So the thing is about this card is I'm excited about it because I'm a filthy stacks player in competitive EDH.
Just you mean like, a gentleman. You're a gentleman.
I'm a scholar. Scholar and a gentleman, yes. A man of finer tastes. You know, what's the point of playing all these cool cards if you don't make your opponent stare at them for like 20 turns? I'm like interested in trying out this card in Derevi just because it, on some level, it solves a bit of an issue that that deck has, which is that, like most of the cards we're playing to actually win are not fantastic. Whereas this slots pretty seamlessly into your game plan in the sense that it's like extremely disruptive. And then if you can clone it, you can start like really locking people out of plays.
I was gonna say, write the replication kicked on this and just choose everything.
Yeah, that's dumb. I'm thinking more of like, you know, a cheaper clone effect. And really all you need is two for competitive BDH because like 99% of the time, if you first lock out instance, people are not gonna have like any removal for this card other than like a toxic deluge. And then if you can copy it and name sorcery, well, it's gonna be exceptionally hard to answer both of those. And then you have two flying vigilance creatures that also combo super well with stasis. So, like, lots of stuff going for it in that deck, at least.
Oh my God. It remains
to be seen if it's going to be good enough. For Bloodpod, I'm, like, less sold on it, just because Bloodpod...
Of course.
Yeah. It's looking to, like, combo out faster, and it's using its stacks more either for, like, grindy value, or else, you know, to push its combo game plan after it's sort of stabilized the board. It's more of like a tempo-oriented stacks deck as opposed to like a lock-oriented stacks deck, like a deck like the Revy, mm-hmm. which, you know, these days, like a lot of people are not playing lock-oriented stacks decks anyway, just because of the developments in the format.
More cards?
Yeah, one that I find very interesting is Generous Patron. That's for two and a green, it's a 1/4 elf advisor. When it enters the battlefield, you support two, so that's a returning mechanic here. Whenever you put one or more counters on a creature you don't control, draw a card.
Hapatra.
It's like, here, I'm killing your dudes. Give me your cards now. You're so generous. I mean,
but I think they made a small mistake with this generous patron. It's not support two. It's support two fighters basically. It's basically you two. I like you guys. Have some money. But yeah, with this with Hapatra is stupid.
Yep, and it curves pretty well too. You know, if you can play Hapatra on two and then play this on three, Hapatra is a deck that I've played against a surprising amount, even like at competitive tables. I don't know that it has the tools to fight against like the format's like really fast combo decks, but if you're playing like a lot of stacks, Hapatra just like eats that matchup alive mm-hmm. because you can attack their mana dorks, you can break parity really easily because you're playing green and you're playing your own mana dorks. And obviously you're getting like tons of recurring value with like Death Touch snakes, that make it hard to attack with Timna and stuff like that. And yeah, so I mean, she's really quite good against stacks decks. Nyxia, so, there's an idea for you. If you really want to make Igor's life miserable, you should build Hapatra. So, you know, when you're playing against his Bloodpod deck.
That's kind of an appealing thought.
Curse you, Jesse.
I'm starting the arms race in your meta from across the ocean.
Nyxia, what sort of thing are you going to do with the patron? Because you're going to do something stupid with this.
I'm actually not. I'm not interested in actually using patron. It's just a cool card with Hapatra.
Oh yeah. Mm. But... we'll talk about last one standing.
Oh, you mean Brawl?
Yeah.
Oh my god. So what does the thing do?
So, Last One Standing is a 1 and a red and a black, a sorcery. Choose a creature at random, then destroy the rest.
Please do the flavor text.
Some train all their lives for a shot at the title. Some just get really, really lucky.
Yeah. The card that we need to read with this one is Thrilling Encore, not because of the card effect. For black instant, put onto the battlefield under your control all featured cards in all graveyards. That they put there from the battlefield this turn, which goes really good with the Last One Standing. But the flavor text is, welcome to the winning team. Basically, guy died, and you know, he's back now.
Right.
And it also has the goblin from the art.
It's definitely something.
So this card is interesting, Last One Standing, because it's the first 3-mana board wipe that we've seen in quite some time. You know, mm-hmm. other than, Bantu's Last Reckoning, I guess.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that one.
Which, that one, that one's a tough sell, because who wants to give up a turn to board wipe? But yeah, no, this one is neat. I don't know that it's actually going to be good enough, just because, like, a lot of the time in competitive, we're really quite concerned about, like, one specific threat, and, like, we want to kill that while also just gaining value by wiping a bunch of other stuff on the board. You know, I'm thinking of something like a Gitrog monster or something like that. And this one, obviously, it has the problem of randomness we hate as competitive players. But in casual, this is going to be fantastic. Three mana board wipe, and, like, a lot of the time you're just killing a bunch of stuff, and that's going to be good enough.
I know that Niksha is going to be playing this card because he used to play Whims of Fate in a really bold manner. This is nothing to him. And Niksha, please tell Jesse what you did with Whims of Fate.
Oh, yeah, I remember. It was a draft, and I was rare drafting, and then I got handed two Whims of the Fate. And I was like, yeah, sure, I'm taking this. And I decided to play it. And I actually, I think I won every round where I played it, because I play Whims of the Fates, and people start thinking about dividing them into piles, or like, what is the least, like, what will they lose the, like, they try to think about it. They make their strategic piles. I just put in one pile, and okay, I have a 33% chance of instantly losing the game. Let's do this.
So yeah, this card is nothing to Niksha. This is just easy mode.
Right.
I mean, so it's most of the time it's not going to kill that one thing that I actually wanted to kill, but for the Lords of Chaos, it must be done.
Right. So
finish.
Yeah, I imagine Niksha is going to be building a Grixis Chaos deck then.
What that was going to say, actually, this card is really good when you're behind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, because even if, you know, you destroy everything besides the biggest creature, you can still easily handle that one big creature.
Or somebody else can, yeah.
Yeah.
It just simplifies things.
And if you just are left with one creature, well, sure, fine, cool.
Right, it takes a lot of pressure off of you in that specific instance. And that's going to be good enough in casual play where, you know, most of the time you're going to be most threatened by, like, the 10-8 legendary worm creature that's swinging and killing you in a few turns. So, yeah, I expect this card to see some play.
And also, you can just make your dudes indestructible and then cast this.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You first attack with the Stonehoof Chieftain and then cast Last One Standing, yeah.
Yep. So, Niksha, what are we going to say?
The only problem I have with this card is I don't really have a deck to fit it in.
Not yet.
Not yet, but I didn't plan on building anything with Rakdos in it for quite some time.
I mean, this is one of those cards that you just get and keep it on the side, and sooner or later you'll get it.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, now you need to decide if you're building Hapatra, if you're building Grixis Chaos, you know?
Choices.
Man, too many choices.
What's next on the docket?
So I think there's a couple more things that we need to talk about. Not cards so much as, like, mechanics. So we have Assist, which is a really neat mechanic and has, like, a lot of really neat cards associated with it. Additionally, we have, like, the friend or foe mechanic that we have yet to touch upon, which is also a lot more interesting than it appears on the surface.
Any examples?
So I think, well, this one is not going to be a fantastic example for, you know, what I wanted to illustrate, which is the sort of complexity of these cards. But Virtus's maneuver, which reads, it's two generic and a black. For each player, choose friend or foe. Each friend returns a creature card from their graveyard to their hand, and each foe sacrifices a creature they control. So in EDH, the way this is going to work most of the time is that because we're not playing a multiplayer format, well, you're going to be your own friend, and everybody else is going to be your foe. And this card is, like, pretty decent in the sense that, like, it's getting you a good amount of value, making all your opponents sacrifice a card, and it's giving you a creature back. So not competitive worthy, but good.
I'm just waiting for my girlfriend to play this in her brush, and she calls herself her foe. Oh, guess I'll just sacrifice this brush. Oh no, what happens now?
So that's a fantastic point, actually, which is and that gets at the complexity of these cards that I wanted to touch upon, and had failed to see that line at the time, which is that, yeah, you can do weird things where you name yourself as a foe because, yeah, you want to use this card as a sack outfit, for instance. But also, you know, maybe one of your opponents has something in their graveyard that you kind of desperately need them to have to address something on the board that's like really mutually threatening. So maybe they become your friend temporarily, right? These cards are really complex in that respect. And this is a much better mechanic than like Tempting Offer. Just for that reason, because it's kind of like you're getting all the choices, which is always, I think, a better design in a card that you're actually going to want to play. You don't want to give your opponents choices. You want to be the one with all the choices. And it's cool when those choices can kind of like differ depending on the situation. And you could reasonably see situations where you would pick what is otherwise not likely to be your first pick.
I mean, choices aren't always bad. Fact or fiction is a card.
Yeah, it's true. You can give your opponents choices when they have to pick between bad and worse.
Yep. Also, you wanted to talk about assist, right?
Yeah, so assist is also another really interesting mechanic, and it kind of gets at what I was getting at earlier, which is, you know, the cards can be quite a bit more complex than they appear on the surface, which is a great design because, first of all, the card is easy to understand, but second of all, it's like complex to actually play it out in practice, which is just good card design. But play of the game is one that I wanted to touch upon. I don't think that this is going to see competitive play just because, well, it's going to be too mana intensive to actually want to run it. But in casual, I could see this working out. So play of the game is a sorcery for 6 generic and 2 white with assist. So another player can pay up to 6 of the generic mana cost of the spell's cost. And then it says exile all non-land permanents. So it's an incredibly powerful board wipe. And if you're playing a control deck, then like, okay, a lot of the time it's going to be too expensive for you to cast on your own. But if somebody else like is also playing with you and they happen to be really behind too, or they also happen to be playing a control deck, well, maybe you can strike a deal with them and have them pay for part of the cost.
Make sure.
Not only just striking a deal, but just being, you know, aware of the situation. If a player is like going to win, then people will have to help you just play play of the game.
Nixia, how does this actually work in multiplayer? Not two-headed giant, just actual multiplayer. How do you actually announce this?
That's a good question.
It's kind of tricky. Because paying for the spell is actually the last thing you do when casting a spell. So I'd say that you like announce it, and if you can't cast it, I don't know what happens then. I mean, it's not a legal action, so I guess it returns to your hand.
Yeah, it's going to create a lot of rewind situations, which is what I was going to say, which is like kind of annoying, I guess. Like that's definitely adding some complexity to just the card itself, as opposed to the way you actually played out in game, which is sort of undesirable. It kind of has like that random Selvala problem, Selvala Explorer Returned, where because that's a mana ability, you can kind of just do it whenever. And if you're using it to pay for costs, well, you can happen to just not have enough mana to cast the spell you're trying to cast. And that just forces a rewind situation where you have to take back all of those actions. But you've revealed information, which is like, it's not ideal. But, you know, I guess there's no better way to design this card.
Also, I mean, yeah, assist is a really cool and complex mechanic, but I'm really, I'm kind of sad that our idea of combo moves didn't get implemented in this set. Like a combination of Surge and Storm, where if one player plays a card, then the other player's like combo card gets cheaper and you know, has a greater effect, and then you can like combo moves until you run out of moves. But
it's MMA, so
yeah.
Actually, this is more pro wrestling than anything.
I mean, especially when you look at the card Gang Up.
Oh god.
With that flavor text, like, well, who do we have here, Gorm? No one, Virtus. No one at all.
Get wrecked.
Oh yeah. And if anybody thinks that I'm not going to play the play of the game music from Overwatch every time I play of the game, they're wrong. They are indeed wrong.
I'm going to have to suffer through this, will I not?
Yes.
One more card I want to talk about that doesn't have anything to do with any of the mechanics is the Sentinel Tower. four.
What do you mean it has nothing to do? It has something to do with Storm. And Storm is always a mechanic.
Oh, basically, artifact, 4-4 generic. Whenever instant or sorcery spell is cast during your turn, Sentinel Tower deals damage to any target equal to 1 plus the number of instant or sorcery spells cast before that spell this turn. So basically, you have a Dramatic Scepter, and this is what you do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a really interesting card, both from a casual and a competitive perspective. So looking at this card, the most immediate first comparison is obviously Aetherflux Reservoir.
Yep.
The thing about Aetherflux Reservoir is that it looks at every card you've played,
mm-hmm.
Which obviously, like, when you're storming off is great because you can cast a bunch of spells, generate a bunch of mana, eventually, like, draw into or tutor for your Aetherflux Reservoir, and then start casting spells, gaining life, and winning that way. But the problem with Aetherflux Reservoir traditionally has always been that it's kind of a dead card before that occurs. Whereas this, you could throw it down theoretically and then just start casting some instants and sorceries as you would, and you just get random value killing mana dorks, you know, killing off Timnas. It's harder to use as like a standalone win condition for like manually storming off, as I described, which is where you're just playing a bunch of cards to generate mana, you know, playing a bunch of mana rocks and stuff like that. kind of like what you would see in like classic storm decks, you know, with rituals and whatnot. So it's not quite as good at doing that, but at the same time, you know, maybe it's possible for these decks to manually storm with instants and sorceries. A lot of these decks are prioritizing Mind's Desire as like a storm outlet anyway. And then finally, you know, for Thrasios and Timna decks, well, these are not really manual storm decks so much anymore. Like, these are decks that are really looking to get, Scepter combo, Dramatic Scepter, Dramatic Reversal and Isochron Scepter online. And this obviously pairs super, super well with that. So I can definitely see this card seeing some play, just because it provides more, incremental advantage. Sorry, yeah. I feel like I geek out every time I talk about a card.
It's all right. That's why we have it here. But I'm just looking. There's a couple more cards we need to talk about, I guess. Diabolic Intent is getting a reprint, and that is really nice.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm excited.
Of course, they reprinted this just as I got an original copy. But, you know, screw me.
At least you have that sweet, sweet art with Krovax on it.
Not just that, it's in Japanese, so it looks even nicer.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
We have a Vigor that's being reprinted finally.
Michelson Gladys.
Oh yeah, that's a fair card that never did anything wrong.
Seedborn Muse also, completely
definitely,
fair.
Definitely.
Probably.
I mean, it actually is, comparing to Prophet of Krufix.
Yeah, that's probably like one of the best cards that they're reprinting in the set.
One of the cards that I'm looking forward to is Greater Good, with that Judge Foil art.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Also Mind's Eyes back for a bit more casual people.
Mm-hmm.
And we have those five lands that check the number of your opponents.
Oh yeah, those are great. I'm super excited for them.
Anything else we missed that's kind of cool?
Well, Stolen Strategy is kind of cool.
Oh yeah, tell us what it is, Nixon.
So Stolen Strategy is a 4 and a red enchantment. At the beginning of your upkeep, exile the top card of each opponent's library. Until end of turn, you may cast non-land cards from among those exiled cards, and you may spend mana as though it were mana of any color to cast those spells.
I mean, this at least bleeds your opponents from spells at the top of the library. At least that.
Yeah, and it makes them, you know, do a bit more topping when they have top.
Mm-hmm. And even if they only reveal lands, you're still cutting lands away from them, theoretically.
Yeah, but in theory, they might just have another land right underneath.
Of course.
That's...
But for mono red, this is a really good thing to have.
Right, and that's what I was gonna say for sure. Is if this card was unfortunately, if only this card was like a little less mana, it could be like the mono red Phyrexian Arena, like really easy. It could be like, you know, you want to run it in pretty much all of your decks.
But red can't have that.
No, red can't have that. That's right.
Also, Mystic Confluence is getting a reprint,
mm-hmm.
which has become quite a money card.
Yeah, but again, it's one of those money cards that's a money card because of limited supply.
Limited supply, and it's played in Legacy.
Yeah.
Those are two reasons.
Yeah, it doesn't see a ton of Legacy play.
But still, it sees a bit, and that's enough. Speaking of Legacy plays, Tidespell Tyrant with new art.
Yep.
If you feel like turn one and two reanimating this, it's always good.
Yeah. I mean, it's no Grizzlebrand, but definitely it is your sort of lock condition in those decks, and it answers some problematic permanents. So yeah, very important target in Reanimator.
Anybody else see anything else interesting? Because the rest are just comments and uncomments.
Together Forever.
Oh, yeah.
Together Forever is actually quite interesting.
What does it do?
It's a double white for an enchantment. When Together Forever enters the battlefield, support 2. You can pay 1 to choose target creature with a counter on it, and when that creature dies this turn, return that card to its owner's hand. So, I mean, off the top of my head, I don't see any, like, combo potential, but there is value potential. There's, like, a lot of value potential in this card.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this card is, it's a cool design for sure. And I have yet to really, like, dig into it to see if there's any combos. I mean, off the top of my head, I can definitely think of, like, 3, maybe 4 card combos if you're, you know, including this with something like Ashnod's Altar. That seems like it would work.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Basically, it's like a lot of hoops to jump through for a competitive EDH card. In casual, yeah, it's going to be a lot of value. I could definitely see it seeing play just because value is fantastic.
I mostly look at it as a value engine, not as a combo engine, and that's it.
Right. Oh, I have a card right beside it in the spoiler that we're all looking at together that I find pretty exciting. Game Plan, which is sort of a functional reprint of a reserve list card, and it's one that's very near and dear to my heart. So Game Plan for 5 and a blue, and it has assist, so that means another player can pay up to 5 of that spell's spell's cost. Each player shuffles their hand and graveyard into their library, then draws 7 cards. And so unfortunately this has like the, time spiral clause where you have to exile it after. But it's still sort of time twister. It's still almost time twister. It's not as good. But
it's best when your opponents pay 3 for the mana cost and just play 2 mana, and you're like, yes, this is time twister almost.
Oh, it's still almost. Yeah, there's so many almost parts of this. You know, the issue with it in competitive, obviously, is that it's way too much mana, and if your opponents are in a position where they're helping you pay for this, you probably don't want to be playing this card because they're clearly going to want those 7 cards. Time twister is at its best when, you know, you do turn 1, play land, play a mana crypt, play a Sol Ring, play like a random like Signet or something, and then you just time twister while everyone, like, you know, after they just did their mulligans and you've just drawn 7 cards after playing out like 5. You have a boatload of mana, and theoretically you just screwed your opponents over by giving them like a, by forcing them to mulligan basically. You know, that's one of the most abusive things you can do in competitive EDH, but then there's the added fact that Time Twister does not exile itself, which is, surprisingly relevant because a lot of decks, well, literally their win condition is just casting Time Twister so that they can recast one particular spell in their deck. You know, Thrasios and Timna decks in particular are very notable for this because Thrasios lets you draw your entire deck. So the sort of downside of Time Twister, which is that it resets card advantage, which is to say that, you know, everybody has a 7 card hand now, it doesn't apply. Because you have infinite mana, you're just going to draw your deck again. And this, in a nutshell, is what we call a Time Twister loop. And the beauty of doing that is that, you know, you wanted to run Time Twister anyway because you wanted to enable those really busted plays that I described earlier. You know, playing it on turn 1 or turn 2 and drawing when your opponents are, you know, don't get quite as much card advantage. But in addition, you're also just going to continuously replay, you know, some other good card in your deck. Like a reality shift or something that is just going to let you win on the spot because, you know, in the case of reality shift, you're just going to exile people's libraries. So like you don't have to run any bad cards. It's absurd.
So this is not a time twister is what you're saying.
This is not a time twister. No. And, you know, we shouldn't evaluate it like a time twister.
Of course.
However, you know, for casual play, I could see it seeing play in decks like Nekusar, obviously. If you're playing Kaidel, you could theoretically want this card. You know,
I think if you're playing Nekusar, nobody's gonna help you pay the spell.
No, probably not. You know, just taking 14 damage for whatever reason seems bad. Most of the time, people aren't gonna help you pay for the spell. If you're casting it at a time that you actually want to cast it.
Yeah.
You know, there's like I guess like corner cases where if somebody just tutored something and you know that they're gonna win, maybe you can do some politics with somebody where you say, hey, look, like, if you pay for part of this, I'll cast it to get this card out of their hand. And, you know, and you hope that they agree to doing that. So yeah, it's an interesting card. And, certain blue decks that are not like blue red, for example, or blue red black in particular in casual are going to appreciate having the extra wheel effect, as we call it. because it's, you know, somewhat similar to Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah. Is this it?
There's one last card that I think is kind of interesting, which is Thrilling Encore.
We mentioned that when we were talking about the...
Oh, yeah, you're right. It's true. We did discuss that.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I mean, we did get another Ling, the Bright Ling.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing.
So now all we're missing is the black one. Bright Ling is a 1 and double white for a 3/3 shapeshifter. For 1 white, you can give it Vigilance or give it Lifelink or return it to its owner's hand. And for 1 generic, you can give it +1/-1 or +1/+1 until end of turn.
Yeah, it's good.
Oh yeah, this card is surprisingly good. I could see this card even theoretically seeing play like in Legacy.
Huh.
I'm not 100% certain it will, but you know, 3 mana for all of those abilities, the fact that it protects itself, the fact that it can provide like a pretty quick clock, and it also like stabilizes if you're playing against other aggressive decks, you know, with Vigilance and Lifelink, means that it's like going to do a lot. It's doing a ton of stuff. You know, the Aetherling, Morphling type cards have traditionally been like control win cons, and this is also where I kind of maybe see this card being. I don't know 100% that it's good enough, but it's like one of the most aggressively costed Ling cards that we've seen thus far. So yeah, it's a really, really exciting design, and it's definitely pushed, I think, to hopefully see some play. So, I mean, while I'm not 100% convinced just yet, I wouldn't be surprised.
Oh, yeah.
Also, we got another way to just one-shot fools in this set with Archfiend of Despair. So it's 6 and double black for a 6/6 flying demon. Your opponents can't gain life, and at the beginning of each end step, each opponent loses life equal to the life that player lost this turn. So pairs really nicely with Havoc Festival and Heartless Hidetsugu.
Also with Vitrus the Veil.
Also that.
Yeah, this is another big scary demon that I'm sure we'll see play in a lot of Kalia decks. Maybe some black reanimator style decks too, or big black decks.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty neat one.
I think that's it.
Well, I do have to say they missed a good opportunity to put in Force of Will, because, you know, there's a guy called Will.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and him on the art, right?
Yep.
Yeah, sure.
So, if that's about it, and I think it is, what do you guys think about this Commander Masters?
Basically it is, yeah. It's awesome.
That's a leading question, but I agree with the sentiment. Yeah, it definitely feels like it's a Commander Masters set. Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I mean, it's quite rare that we get like any cards that are going to be relevant for competitive Commander. To get a few that could theoretically be relevant is always fun. And yeah, it just looks like a super fun set to just play. So I'm really looking forward to drafting it and playing it.
Well, I think that has been it for the Battle Bond set. Jesse, where can people find you if they want to, you know, communicate with you or anything else?
Yeah, well, so we are called Team Turn 3. That's, you know, team like you would imagine it, turn like you would imagine it, and 3, like the turn that we're trying to win. And basically, yeah, so you can find us on YouTube just by looking up Team Turn 3 or on Facebook. If ever you want to message any of us to just, you know, talk about competitive Commander, get some insight about some deck building questions, stuff like that, feel free to message us on Facebook. I'm usually pretty good about getting back to people very quickly. And then additionally, you know, you can find us on Twitter. And yeah, you should come check out some of our videos, because we put out, or we will be soon putting out again. We've been on a bit of a hiatus. We will be again putting out some competitive Commander videos pretty soon. So yeah, that's that.
Yeah, okay. Well, this has been episode 72 of the Elder Dragon Guild podcast, if I remember correctly. This has been Igor.
And this has been Niksha.
And as always, the Emperor protects.
He indeed does.
The Emperor.